I still remember where I was the first time it hit me. I maybe do have ADHD. And it's funny, I posted a TikTok the other day about having ADHD, and a good friend of mine texted me and said, "Remember when you swore to me you didn't have ADHD?" Oh, goodness. Well, listen, if you relate to that at any point in your life, I want to share a podcast that you should tune into. It's called ADHD Aha, hosted by Laura Key. It's candid stories from people who share the moment it clicked that they or someone they know has ADHD. In each episode, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, and even funny ways that ADHD symptoms can surface for adults. And it doesn't always look the way we thought it would. So check it out. To listen to ADHD Aha, search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha, with Aha spelled A-H-A. Hello, you sentient balls of stardust. Welcome to Struggle Care. My name is Casey Davis. I'm your host. And today we are with Dr. Leslie Hatchgale, PhD. Yeah, I want to put the doctor in there every time. Leslie and I have been following each other on TikTok for a while. And Leslie, will you just sort of introduce yourself? Tell us what you do, who you are.
Wow. Okay. So like a big question, right? So I have a professional organizing business, Declare Order Professional Organizing. I've been doing that for about 12 years. Prior to that, I was an educator in early childhood special education. So I came to professional organizing from a place of looking at people's strengths and what they're good at and using that to teach them how to help them make changes in their space. And I wasn't so concerned with sort of the middle of the bell curve way of organizing. Then as I'm going along and I'm doing those things, I really fell into learning more about people who have hoarding challenges. And it kind of reminded me of the early childhood special education days of when I was working with children with autism, autistic students, and we were just learning. This was right at the beginning of learning how to really teach them and educate. And we had picture schedules and it was all very groundbreaking. We had little Polaroid cameras. And this reminded me of that. I felt like the people with hoarding challenges that I was seeing on those TV shows weren't being seen and heard properly. So that was, I ended up doing a deep dive into it and thought, I need to study this more. And then I had like this midlife crisis PhD.
I want to talk about the show Hoarders. I just want your thoughts, your insights.
That's how I found out about it, about hoarding, was from what I call it, those TV shows, right? Hoarders and Hoarding Buried Alive. And I was watching those. I was not a professional organizer at the time. And that's where I had this reaction. Like, this is odd to me that they're coming in and they're meeting a person in a time of stress and they're forcing them to do something that's unnatural and uncomfortable. And then the families are all fighting. And it just was really uncomfortable, but I couldn't put my finger on why exactly. And I thought, I'm going to write a book, which I have done. It's a middle grade fiction novel. It just hasn't made it out of the computer yet. But from the point of view of a child living in a home, because that was my background, right? So I was trying to picture, like, how is child development impacted by living this way? And in my research, I found out about professional organizing. So the long way around to say, I end up being a professional organizer. And 4 months later, someone who I had met, the president of my local chapter of organizers, said, "We've been called to do an episode. Do you want to join us?" Because she knew that she and I had talked. So here I am, 4 months into starting a business, and I'm driving down to downstate Illinois to film an episode of Hoarders, you know, with Geraldine Thomas, who at the time was like kind of a superstar host and all that. And I learned very quickly that, like, it was just a TV show, right? They had a storyline. They brought in this dramatic team to, we were all volunteers and we did what we could to, but it was almost like they would move stuff out of the way to film the shot and then move it back. And, you know, I wasn't sure that the people were being helped necessarily. I mean, there's the clean out and it's addressing the immediate problem and making the environment safer. But I wasn't sure. But I did go on to do two more episodes of it as a volunteer on the team. And it's been over my journey of research and over a period of time that what I say now is that I find them exploitative. However, they have raised awareness about hoarding in an incredible way. There's no way that kind of reach could have happened. And so when I did my research study and I'm talking to people and they're saying, I didn't know that I grew up in a hoarded home. I didn't know I was a child of hoarding parents until I watched the TV shows. Like, oh, that's what happened to me. Or I talked to people, interviewed people who identify as having hoarding challenges because of the TV show, and they know they need to do something about it before it gets to that level. So I get phone calls from people and they'll say, I'm not like that on TV. You know, I'm not like that bad. But
yeah, no, there is something really, well, first of all, I think one of the things that I appreciate doing and love doing and try to do on this podcast, it's like taking a thing and doing like the most difficult human thing, which is holding it in all of its complexity, where it's like, there are parts of this that are, we would maybe say negative, and then there are parts of this that we would say positive. And even that is not even the right language, where it's like, sometimes a thing just is. And I think our tendency is to either want to hold it up and go, this is such a great thing, or we want to sort of push it down and go, here are all the problems with this. It's so awful. And it's a lot more difficult to just talk about something, as you said, like, listen, there are some issues here and there are some ripple effects here and there's some ripple effects here. And I do totally resonate with what you're talking about, because there's something about the recognition that what you're struggling with isn't unique, where you realize like, oh, maybe I'm not broken. Like, maybe this is something, not just my own falling apart inability to do something. Because if so many people are demonstrating this same pattern of behavior, and it's, even if it doesn't look exactly like mine, I don't know, but I feel like that offers a little bit of hope.
Right. It gives you a sense of community, like a place to belong. I noticed that in comment sections when I've talked about this topic, even on TikTok, the people that identify as being children of hoarding parents, they can talk to each other and say, oh my gosh, I didn't realize this was sort of a universal children of hoarding parents experience, and they find some commonality and some common ground. And there's something powerful in that, knowing it's not just you.
Well, you have an interesting confluence of interests, because one of the things that I did learn from the hoarding shows, to their credit, they did make a point to go into someone's background and talk about the trauma that they had experienced, instead of just going in and being like, look at, get a load of this, right? Like, they connected it to like, there have been some real difficulties here that, you know, along with some other factors have led to this hoarding disorder or these hoarding tendencies. And I don't, you know, that's really the first, I mean, even with a counseling degree, that's the first time that I learned about that.
Right. That's the most recent conference that I went to just the other weekend. It was even brought up, like, should it even be called hoarding disorder? Because there's so many co-occurring conditions and so many other things going on that why are we identifying it by just the most visible tip of the iceberg piece? Maybe it should be identified a different way, that hoarding is a symptom. That was just something that came to my attention that was, you know, a conversation that was had.
You know what it reminds me of is, for those who are not familiar with, like, all of the mental health diagnoses are in a book, like a big diagnostic book. And with a lot of disorders, for example, like anorexia, when you get a diagnosis, there are also what's called subtypes. So like, you can get a diagnosis of anorexia, and then you can also get a subtype of binge purge, which basically says like, this is a person that meets all the criteria for anorexia. And there are these other subset of symptoms where they are binging and purging over and over and over. Same with like ADHD, like you could get an inattentive type or a hyperactive type or a mixed type. And, you know, when you first brought that up, my first thought was like, I wonder if it like better fits a different disorder. It's just like hoarding type or with hoarding tendencies. Like, you can sometimes like dock those things on.
Right. So it'd be interesting to see where the research takes it over the next decade, because it was just added as its own standalone diagnosis in 2013, where I think before it was, I don't want to say it incorrectly, but I think it was a subtype of OCD before. So you could have OCD with hoarding tendencies, and then it, now its own. But now it's like, maybe the subtype was, to your point, like, maybe that's more accurate.
So if somebody is listening and they don't really know anything about hoarding disorder, they might be surprised to hear that hoarding disorder was a subset of OCD. And even to this day, it's still in the chapter on obsessive disorders, or I don't remember what the, like, it's still kind of lumped in the similar disorders. They might be surprised to hear that it is close to OCD. So can you kind of explain why that is?
Well, it has to do with compulsion. plain and simple. Like, it's that instead of compulsion for ritualistic behaviors around cleanliness, it's sort of compulsion for ritualistic behaviors about what to do with belongings. And many of the people's homes that I've been in that have these tendencies, it's fascinating. And I've heard you talk about it, actually, I think, on a recent episode about dealing with the garbage and what to do with trash and how to process trash and keep it out of the landfill. And there's so many blocks that they have with being able to get rid of something for those reasons. Oh, I know what it was. It was that hoarder. It was a different podcast you were a guest on, and you talked about that. What was that hoarder, or what is it called? I forget.
Yeah. I can't remember. I've been on so many podcasts. I know what podcast you're talking about, but I can't remember the name of it.
It was a good episode.
When Breath Becomes Air by Paul Kalanithi is the exquisitely observed memoir of an idealistic young neurosurgeon attempting to answer the question, what makes a life worth living, as he deals with his own terminal cancer diagnosis. It's a stunning reminder to live while we're alive, a must-read for anyone in medicine, from a doctor-turned-patient. For healthcare workers, expand your view on patient care and the fragile beauty of our mortal lives through Kalanithi's unforgettable words. Some of the questions Kalanithi wrestles with in this book include, what makes a life worth living in the face of death? What do you do when the future flattens out into a perpetual present, when the future no longer is a ladder towards your goals in life? What does it mean when you have a child to nurture a new life as another fades away? When Breath Becomes Air is a number one New York Times bestseller, Pulitzer Prize finalist, and was named one of the best books of the year by the New York Times Book Review, People, NPR, The Washington Post, Slate, and more. When Breath Becomes Air is available wherever books are sold. Learn more at prh.com/breath. Shout out to Claritin for giving me some free samples and for sponsoring this podcast. I am a seasonal allergy sufferer, which means that sometimes I'm lying in bed reading a book that is super happy and my husband says, what's wrong? Why are you crying? Because I am sniffling and he thinks I'm crying. But no, it's just seasonal allergies. Luckily, that does not happen anymore because I use Claritin D. We can live Claritin clear with Claritin D. Designed for serious allergy sufferers, Claritin D has two powerful ingredients in just one pill that relieve your allergy symptoms and decongest your nose. This double action combination of prescription strength allergy medicine and the best decongestant available relieves sniffing, sneezing, watery eyes, itchy nose and throat. It's great. Ready to live life as if you don't have allergies? It's time to live Claritin clear. Fast and powerful relief is just a quick trip away. Find Claritin D at the pharmacy counter. As for Claritin D at your local pharmacy counter, you don't even need a prescription. Go to Claritin.com right now for a discount so you can live Claritin clear. Use as directed.
Hey, if you enjoyed my episode on IEPs and you want to listen to more podcast episodes about IEPs, I want to tell you about another podcast you should check out. It's called Understood Explains. This season, the show is hosted by teacher and special education expert Juliana Ertube, and it's all about how to navigate individual education plans, also known as IEPs. You might have heard me talk about IEPs on my episode, and this latest season of Understood Explains covers topics like how to tell if your child needs an IEP, and it busts common myths about special education. I checked out these episodes, and I think that they are a great place for you to go after listening to mine. They go into a little more detail and answer a little more in depth about what an IEP is and whether your child needs one. So listen to Understood Explains by searching for Understood Explains in your podcast app. That's Understood Explains. And the show Hoarders showed like pretty extreme cases. Do you find that people are surprised to learn that maybe they're dealing with the same issue because their house does not look anything like those sort of extreme cases?
I think if they've seen the television show, they know that it could end up that way. That seems to be the universal response. It's like, I don't want to end up like that, or it's, you know, it's not as bad as that. The people that have the awareness to say it's not as bad as that are usually not someone with hoarding challenges, by the way. Like, there can be chronic disorganization, which is different than hoarding. So I guess I could take a second to say what I find the easiest way to explain the difference is with hoarding, it's like a stuffed salad where you've got socks with notebooks, with food wrappers, with glasses, with earrings, with hangers, where when it's chronic disorganization, usually it's a little bit more categorized than that. You might have a room full of stuff, but it's all old clothes and shoes and some coats, you know, but they're all jumbled, but it's not this stuffed salad that you get with the hoarding.
Interesting. What is it that leads to the stuffed salad?
It's just a way of going through the environment almost with like blinders on. It's so fascinating to watch someone with hoarding challenges when you're in their space, because they put something to the side and then it's gone, right? And things just end up on top of each other because they're not delineating the different, oh, this is a plate. I should put the plate here so that I don't forget, you know, and you at least put maybe all your utensils at least in a similar place, or, you know, they're, but it, things just kind of, you watch it, it's called churning, the behavior where they're going through their stuff without actually making decisions, and that churning. So I learned that very early on working with someone with paperwork. They had to work with me because DCFS was on the case. The social worker discovered the conditions in the home. I would do it differently now, and I would do more to address the children's, the child's experience, because now I know more. But at the time I didn't. But I was in the home and working on bills. And what I decided was I would put the bills in plastic bags by type, in the gallon size bags. And we made a filing system of bags, because the person with hoarding challenges would just pull out paper and it would spread everywhere. And it would get lost in into piles, because it just would all turn into this salad, right? The lettuce is everywhere, in between the olives and the carrots and everything else. But by having one little bag at a time, it didn't go as far, or she could see in the bag and just pull out one or two items and put them back in. And it helped things to not get, to undo the work that we had done, like in between appointments.
What's interesting is that when I think of, so I'm somebody who, because of my ADHD, like experiences disorganization, and my house is pretty organized now, but it's still kind of messy. But one of the things that I am like hearing when you describe that is like, when I come to a room that's maybe like a doom room or a doom pile where everything's kind of all mixed together and I want to organize it, the first step is like pulling everything out and spreading it out and churning through everything, because I'm like, I'm mentally trying to like understand what's there, understand what do I need, understand what da-da-da-da. But then I move on to like the second phase of that, right? Which is making decisions about what I need or where it needs to go. That doesn't seem like a foreign thing to like churn and to like, I understand that, but it's almost like people get stuck there.
Yes.
Like it just starts looping. You know what I mean? Like it just starts looping and they can't move forward to the
categorization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know this, like I've listened to people on the shows and stuff talk about how it's almost like this inability to really make decisions about what is important and what isn't, because it seems like everything's important.
Yes. And I've worked with clients before too, that they, you can really see that they don't know what to prioritize. And so I'm going to add colored paper to this or colored marker to this and make it more important. But then when everything in the room has all the different colors on it, then nothing's important again. And so teaching through and figuring out, helping someone learn. And I know that some of the techniques that some of the researchers, you know, that they've come up with are things like calling an, and you probably heard this, calling an item a friend. In fact, I think I've seen, done post on that with your kids, like with their toys. Is it a friend? Is it an acquaintance? Or is it family? And helping to teach how to feel about the stuff and how to prioritize it.
So I wanted to talk about children, because one of the things that has been interesting with my channel, you know, learning, you kind of talked about the difference between individual psychology and community psychology. And I kind of heard a parallel to that, because I am so used to one-on-one talking with someone and kind of explaining concepts to them and tailoring those wording to that person, to having this large audience where you have so many different people in the audience. And when I've been talking about care and self-care and care tasks, particularly about space, it's been really interesting to try and figure out the way to talk about that that is honoring to two different types of demographics at the same time. And one is that person or that parent who is, like, let's take hoarding, for example, who is hoarding, who is struggling, who needs, as we know, like needs compassion and needs skills, and to whom shame will send them further down the spiral. And I know that children that were traumatized or neglected in hoarding environments are listening, and they so desperately want and need to hear, that was wrong. You deserved better. You know, they should have done anything possible to get that help, to make sure you were safe. And it's interesting to know both of those people are listening. And how do you validate and help and have compassion to both demographics? Because sometimes it feels like, you know, in order to validate children, you have to be like, yeah, that was the most screwed up thing that ever happened. And then, of course, somebody who's listening and is hoarding is now kind of falling apart because they're like, great, I'm damaging everyone. Why do I even try? And I'm curious if you can kind of speak to your experience and with learning about the effects it has on children and what the impact on children is.
I've spent a lot of time over the past couple of years with the director of the Minor and Youth Initiative of the Children of Hoarders 501c3. It's a nonprofit. And what I've learned from her is they're just trying to raise awareness that it can be traumatic for children. And just being able to bring that up and talk about it is really helpful, to be able to acknowledge it. And if there's someone that can be in that child's life to provide a different kind of role model, if that child can seek out, or the teenager that's watching, you know, it helping them find someone, or maybe it's going to the friend's house or, you know, another family member or teacher or somebody. So we're with the two of us and her organization, they're trying to raise awareness with social workers, with coaches, trying to work on how to get that word out there that if they people can learn to identify, I'm talking to a child that might be living in a house that is experience has hoarding going on, but I can't do anything because I'm just the soccer coach. But this is how I can help this child, maybe in being aware of things that can help that child get past some of the and be a stronger, more resilient little person. But then the parent, because you can't necessarily get in and make a change. And then the parents, and I guess I have in my head from podcast I listened to with you a couple weeks ago, that just the parent just, they might not be able to acknowledge it at that point, but just if they can and know that their child can see them making that effort to make a little bit of a change. But that's not always realistic. Those two things are going to happen at the same time.
I think that's really important because, you know, if all you've ever been exposed to are like the hoarding shows, it really does feel like, okay, what the option is to fix this problem, you know, hire all these people, get all these people on site, clean everything out, like make sure they have a safe place. And in reality, like you said, the soccer coach, the next door neighbor, the teacher, the person that is coming in contact with a child that's living in maybe a hoarded environment, they don't have those resources. They can't make those things. And it can feel so powerless to go, okay, as I'm thinking, like even as a therapist, if I have a client that is struggling with hoarding and I know they're small children and I'm going, okay, well, I don't have like the resources of a hoarding show, but the idea that there are small things we can do to mitigate impact. And even as a therapist thinking like there could be a harm reduction approach that can still be honoring and helpful. And, you know, that's something that I run into a lot when people are listening to me is we get so stuck on these all or nothing black and white thinking that sometimes you'll hear someone say, oh my God, the idea that I could just do one dish. And I'm just thinking to myself, you know, if I'm sitting in an environment that there's a lot of hoarding going on and I'm thinking the only option to help my child is I have to figure out how to fix all of this. When in reality, like maybe there's some more reachable goals in regards to that child's room.
And things that don't focus on the stuff. Like one kind of occupation that's just starting to come into the conversation now is occupational therapy. In part because they're the ones who maybe you can get insurance to cover. But what an occupational therapist can do is to come in and make sure that you won't fall down because of the way this is set up. And they don't look at organizing and sorting. And they're looking at how can I make it so that you can walk to the bathroom safely and use the sink and place this glass here and it won't fall over. And so bringing them into the conversation now is a nice neutral option that's starting to gain awareness. So that way it's not just focusing on you got to get rid of all this. It's how can we make it safer and more functional for you? And so if they could think about it that way, to help the child. You don't want things, the pile to fall on them, for example. You know, the piles get high and they get tumbly. And so what can we do to just rearrange that so that you can walk through here without twisting your body?
And I like what you said about, like, if that child can see that parent just making an effort, because a lot of times when I speak to children that have gone through really any kind of, especially neglectful environment, obviously, like, no matter what, living in a hoarded environment is going to cause distress to a person because it's just not functional and it's hard to live in. But there's always this layer of pain that really goes even deeper than that with a child where they go, like, my mom didn't care enough. She didn't see. And I know as a mom, like when we struggle, it's really like I've never had a struggle where I've thought my children aren't worth it. But I also know from my background with addiction and with other sort of disorders like that, that as a child, what you feel like is if I was good enough, if I was worthy enough, this person would be able, like this person would make me more important than this struggle. And I think we can't underestimate the impact that a child observing a parent just try, even if it doesn't change the function, the environment, you know what I mean? Like the amount, the like, what's the term that we use for like, it's like when someone experiences trauma, there are factors that can like mitigate the harm of that trauma. I don't know. Everyone's listening to this, screaming it at their radio because they know and I can't think of it. But anyways, you know what I mean? Like, I think that can't be understated is like, even if you feel hopeless to change, like it can be a huge change to your child to just observe that messaging of you are worth it. I am trying. Here's a small thing that I'm doing.
When it comes to hoarding where it's really severe, they might not be ready to do that yet. But even just thinking about it, like I've learned a lot about stages of readiness and even just becoming aware that you need to do something, that means that the next step is maybe planning to do something. And then the next step is doing something. So even if you're not doing something yet, keep thinking about it. Keep sitting in that space of maybe I should be doing something, because that's progress. If you've gone from not doing anything to just thinking about it, because that's the only place you can go from, you know.
That's great advice. Because I think sometimes when we think about changing and we don't, we end up bailing on that stage because we think, well, I'm thinking about it, but I'm not doing it. What a piece of junk I am. I shouldn't, like, I don't even know why I'm kidding myself. And then we go back into kind of a denial. When in reality, like of the stages of change, the first stage is thinking about changing. And so I love your encouragement to no, stay there, stay there. Stay there. That's good. It's good to be there. Don't beat yourself up that you're not the next one yet. Stay there because that you have to be there in order to get to the next one, right?
Remember in 2018 when Border Patrol separated thousands of refugee kids from their parents, deported those parents back to their home countries while keeping the kids in the United States? Well, believe it or not, 6 years later, there are hundreds of families who have still not been reunited. Although we as a community may feel hopeless at times, I recently learned about an organization called El Otro Lado, which works to reunify families. They provide holistic legal and humanitarian support to refugees, deportees, and other migrants in the U.S. and Tijuana through a multidisciplinary, client-centered, harm reduction-based practice. Since 2018, they've reunified over 100 refugee families ripped apart by Trump's zero-tolerance policy. Once reunited, El Otro Lado helps each family find legal representation, housing, and the counseling that they need in order to heal and get on their feet. You can find the link to donate to El Otro Lado in the description of this episode or go to gum.fm/charity and donate today. You can also consider volunteering with the organization, which offers opportunities that are both in-person and virtual. The best way to get involved is by filling out an application on their website, alotrolado.org/volunteer. That's A-L-O-T-R-O-L-A-D-O.
A few weeks ago, my husband's beloved grandfather died, and it's been a really sad time for our whole family. But one of the moments of light in this whole process was shortly after he passed away, I got an email from my mother-in-law, and she had sent all of us a link to his Storyworth book. I don't know if you're familiar with Storyworth, but I have a new appreciation for them now that we have a Storyworth book on my husband's grandfather. Here's how it works. Each week, Storyworth emails your loved one a thought-provoking question that you get to help pick. Storyworth makes the writing process a breeze. All your loved one needs to do is respond to that email with a story, long or short, it doesn't matter. And then you get emailed a copy of their response as they're submitted in the course of a year. You'll get to enjoy the retelling of their stories that you already know or be surprised by stories you've never heard before. And after that year of fun, Storyworth compiles your loved one's stories and photos into a beautiful keepsake hardcover book that you'll be able to share and revisit for generations to come. You can even keep a copy of the book for yourself. I am so grateful to my mother-in-law for doing this with her dad. We love it. Families love Storyworth. That's why it has more than 25,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot, with millions of stories preserved since they were founded over 10 years ago. So Mother's Day is coming up, and I want to give all the moms in your life a unique, heartfelt gift that you will cherish for years. Right now, save 10% on your first purchase when you go to storyworth.com/struggle. That's storyworth.com/struggle to save $10 on your first purchase. Whether it's Mother's Day, Father's Day, or just because you know that sometimes time is short and you want to capture those memories. So I'm wondering if we can close with maybe a couple of pieces of like practical advice or moves. I would love if you can remember any of the practical things that the organization was talking about for like what you can do for a child that you notice is in a hoarding environment.
Oh, right. So you want to give them a way to talk about what's going on, and they may not be able to identify what's going on. So one of the things that we're working on is this sort of icebreaker worksheet for people in the community to use when they think that might be something that's going on. And it's questions like, what is it like where you sleep? You know, tell me about your sleeping environment, because in a situation where there's hoarding, the child is probably not in their own bedroom with a door they can close and sleeping on a bed. They're probably in the couch in the living room surround. You know, so those questions about like, what is that like? What is sleeping like? Or do you often run late for things because the parent might not be able to get coordinated with their schedule to get, and that's a general one, but they all impact and add up over a period of time. Or can you not have appliances fixed in your home because you can't let anyone in? I mean, we didn't really talk about secrecy and shame and all that, but you know, that's a whole other thing. But so being able to just kind of, in an almost roundabout way, you know, asking questions about the conditions of the home without pointing fingers and without saying, you just be like, are you able to use the stove or the bath? And kind of going through those questions as an assessment or a way to an icebreaker to start the conversation. And that way you can learn a little bit about what their daily experience is like.
Well, I can imagine like even something as simple as like bringing a child a lunch. If you know that like they don't have a sanitary environment to prepare food, or if you know like the fridge hasn't been opened in so long, like I think sometimes as people, we're not very good dealing with the powerlessness that we can feel in the face of somebody else's pain that we can't fix. Well, I was going to say, it's easier to just kind of shut down than to wade into it and do the one thing that you can do and just learn to deal with the hopelessness.
Yeah. And I worked as a before and after school care director for a few years recently, in addition to organizing. And one of the things I noticed was sometimes in schools, like a child who's not prepared for school, is not ready, their backpack is a mess, their desk is a mess, they get picked on, or the teacher, they're always in trouble. Instead of asking, why is that child that way? Why are they coming unprepared? What maybe is going on in the house? How can I teach that child rather than expect them to know? Because it may be that no one's teaching them. So your videos about cleaning, and people, I think they even were asking you, like, can you just show us how to clean? Because no one ever taught us, right? So if you're coming into contact with a child who isn't coming prepared, is there something you can teach them? Because sometimes children of hoarding parents have to be their own parent, but with those skills, they can learn to do those things and do their own laundry and make their own lunch and some of those things, but they don't know they can. But if someone gives them those tools to teach them how, then it's easier for them to be more resilient later when they're adults and they come with those skills.
I love the schools that I've seen that have put in like a hygiene closet where a student can come in and get a bottle of shampoo. They can come in early and get their hair brushed and braided. Because, and not just hoarding, but like you just really don't know where students are coming from, and to have a safe place for them to go get ready before they go into class, so they're not experiencing that peer bullying or teasing or just that spotlight that goes on them. I think that's a great, also like community-led thing. Like if you are associated with a public school, if you live near a public school, if you're looking for a way to be involved with your child's school, I think having something like that can make a big change for all sorts of children. Okay, what about somebody who's listening and they're going, okay, this is me. This is me. And I've been needing to reach out for help. Like, do you have any little actionable pieces about reaching out for help? Like, who do they even call about that? Because obviously not everybody, you know, do I call an organizer? Do I call a therapist? Do I call, like, what do I call?
Right. Well, that's really the $1 million question, right? What are you ready to call? Like, are you ready to just talk and call a therapist? And you have access to that kind of support and you can pay for that, or how that would work for you. Does that sound appealing? It doesn't have to be an organizer to start. Like it doesn't, it can be an occupational therapist to start, you know, to help if you're worried you're going to fall and hurt, break your hip or something. Starting with an organizer, sometimes you have to make sure that that person is trained and they know. So you call a few people and talk and see how they, I get referrals more often than not from other organizers in my area because they know they can't ethically do and help a person that calls. And let's see, so you see what you're comfortable with, what sounds like something. But one of the things you also might think about is what can you do? Maybe there's, you can't do anything about the stuff right now because you're not ready, but you could do something for your financial health. You could change your Amazon shopping habits, your QVC shopping habits, and take that credit card off of the account and slow the roll of the stuff coming in that you know you're not going to let out. Could be one thing that's like, okay, well, I could do that. I could do something with financial and get control of that. Or maybe social. You know, you want to be able, your daughter won't allow the kids to come over because maybe there's one room that you could get to where you could agree that it would be safe to have the grandkids come over or a friend come over. So you're fixing your social health.
And I will say this, I don't in general have a lot of faith in CPS because of historically how biased they can be. But I do know, and there have been times where, you know, me or someone I work with, because we are mandatory reporters, if we find out about an abusive or neglectful environment, and there are definitely some stages of hoarding that would be included in that, we are mandated to call the state and we could lose our license if we don't. And what I've seen for, and so this is kind of a note for professionals as well, but what I've seen work well when you have to make that mandatory reporting, but you know, oh God, this is going to really sever the relationship. This is going to bring all of these like worse things onto this person, is to reach out to that person and just be honest with them and say, here's the situation. Here's what I have to do. Here's what I think we can do together to mitigate the most harm and get the most help, which is to have that person, if they're willing, join you on that call to be able to say, I've talked with my therapist. She's told me she has to call. And to be honest, I'm hoping you can help me.
And the other thing communities can do is get the ADA, the American with Disability Act, invoke that because that gives you more time. If the city's saying you have to do this in 2 weeks, say, no, this person cannot actually do that in 2 weeks because you can see they have this disability. And that's another new way of approaching. And so it can give them 6 months instead of 2 weeks. And that awareness is increasing in communities as well.
Thank you for mentioning that. But yeah, but as a professional, again, it's not like some, oh, this is definitely not going to be harmful to you anymore. But it certainly can go a long way, especially in the specific caseworkers that get assigned to you. Their impressions coming, and it's a little like kind of getting ahead of what might be their bias of, you know, how do I need to deal with this? How do I, you know, how strict do I, it's like, okay, I'm sitting with my client. They're hoping you have the resources to help. They're hoping you can help them. And sometimes that first impression can help mitigate the trauma and the disruption and the harm that can be caused by something like CPS or Adult Protective Services. Well, Leslie, thank you so much. This has been a really great conversation. I appreciate you just jumping on with me and winging it with me. I will link some of the things that you mentioned.
Thank you for having me.
Awesome.
If you're a parent, I invite you to join us at the Mindful Mama podcast, where it's all about becoming a less irritable, more joyful parent. With sometimes hilarious and always thought-provoking experts and friends, at Mindful Mama, we know that you cannot give what you do not have. And when you have calm and peace within, then you can give it to your children. I'm Hunter Clark Fields, and I can't wait to see you there. Listen in to the Mindful Mama podcast.